This episode was created with the support of Free FM, Hamilton, New Zealand's community access media organisation. Visit us at freefm.org.nz.
Hello and welcome to a very special episode of Paleface Parabola. My name is Ricardo, aka El Profesor, aka The Quizzed. But there's no time for further introductions because this is a tune.
Humming at the heart of a factory town. All my life I've been working them angels overtime, writing and writing and living so close to the
close to the edge, working their angels
That was Rush with Working Them Angels from their 2007 record Snakes and Arrows, one of my favourites from the legendary Canadian trio. And this episode is going to be all about music trios. Triangles are the strongest shape, and given the longevity of the classic rock trio as a staple, that same geometry lesson must therefore apply to music as well. Now, I've been in and around radio for a minute now, and low-hanging fruits aren't exactly my flavour. And Rush are often called the best rock trio of all time, but there is one more classic trio that I simply can't omit and live with myself. So let's get through that before we dig much deeper. I was blessed enough to see this next band in 2005 and then once again in 2007. Simply put, they are the greatest rock and roll band of all time. And since I did used to enjoy a bevy or several back in those days, I can say I had the authentic Motorhead experience not once, but twice. The party ended with the passing of Lemmy in 2015, of course, and I am grateful that no one has tried to take the man's place in Motorhead because Lemmy was Motorhead, and it's a no-substitutions-will-do kind of situation. Overkill from 1979 might be the perfect rock record, oozing raw machismo and Jack Daniels. It's the sort of album that only sounds perfectly right when playing on a cassette in a moving vehicle. Music streaming just could never replicate it. And it wasn't even the only classic that Motorhead released that year, with Bomber arriving 7 months later. Seriously, from 79 to 82, Motorhead were untouchable. Overkill kicks off with the iconic title track, but right down the tail end of the record, you'll find one of my lesser-known favourites from the band, Metropolis. We'll be right back. As a child of the 90s, you'll have to forgive me for looking at the Bee Gees as being that corny pop group who used to make cringy disco music. Perhaps if you got to live through their, air quotes, heyday, your perspective might be different. And that is fair, but this is my show, so this is how I tell it. So can you imagine my delight when I learned that before they infected Saturday Nights Forevermore, the Bee Gees used to be a real band? The Gibb brothers from the Isle of Man, in fact, had an entire career as a psychedelia-inflected vocal group before the disco lifestyle took them. Their work in the 60s was such a far cry from what I heard in my childhood that I am compelled to wonder what happened to them to inspire such a change. There's some kind of chutzpah involved when a group goes around and calls their third album by the name of First. Bee Gees First was released in 1967. Now, it's either a stroke of genius or really, really annoying, but it is something. I mostly know this next song because it was covered by a band I like a lot more than the Bee Gees, but I don't think that the path that you take to find the good music matters quite as much as the destination. This is Every Christian Lion-Hearted Man Will Show You. The 60s and 70s were jam-packed with gritty, hard-rocking three-pieces, but obviously they didn't all receive the same level of acclaim and adulation. I feel that it is my job to insist that that is no excuse to not give them their due spotlights. For every Cream or ZZ Top, there were a dozen bands like Budgie, the James Gang, and our next entry, the Groundhogs. Formed in London in 1963, the Groundhogs originally started as a traditional rock quartet before slipping into a more efficient arrangement for their second album in 1969. Blue Obituary was followed a year later by Thank Christ for the Bomb, which could easily be one of the most underrated rock records of its day, but I suspect that its name might have something to do with that. The group's bass-heavy approach, courtesy of Peter Cruikshank, gave the Groundhogs a chunkier sound, which, spoiler alert, would go on to influence at least one more group coming up later in the episode. As a bit of an eccentric man myself, I quite like their track, Eccentric Man. Now, at the top of the show, I said this episode was all about trios, but I never said I'd be strictly sticking to rock trios. Because when I think of trios of musicians, my mind doesn't instantly go to three hairy, sweaty dudes jamming out in foggy basements. I think of jazz. And what is more classic or classy than a traditional jazz trio? I had some trouble deciding on which jazz trio to feature here. Names like Oscar Peterson and Ahmad Jamal cast very long shadows across the genre, but for my money, the Bill Evans Trio is about as classic as it gets. From 1955 to 1979, the man behind the piano led a group of the swinginest cats in town, paired perfectly with Scott LaFaro on bass and Paul Motian on the drums. One of the trio's most enduring works is their seminal 1960 record, Portrait in Jazz, which came at a time when the genre was running parallel to pop music. It made sense to take some of the popular tunes of the day and give them this extra new lease on life by folding them in with the great jazz canon. The song Witchcraft was a hit for Frank Sinatra in 57, and again for good old Bill Evans in 1960. moving along a little in the timeline all the way up to the 1980s, which were indeed a fascinating time. It seemed like every year a brand new style, genre, or attitude of music appeared out of nowhere. In the 1980s, the term alternative entered the vernacular. Considering the arrival of bands such as Sonic Youth, Flaming Lips, Melvins, and Butthole Surfers around the time, I think the term alternative was quite appropriate. One of the lesser talked about groups from this first wave of alt-rock were one of my favourites. Hailing from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, Violent Femmes weren't your typical rock stars, even amongst their oh-so-alternative peers. Whereas much of the genre was mired in bad-acid guitars and stoner poetry, the Femmes wrote sharp songs that dripped with an endearing, if awkward, sincerity. In more recent times, they have broken their golden triangle with the addition of multi-instrumentalist and former child actor Blaise Garza, but that feels like a story for another day. Chances are, if you know of Violent Femmes, it is by way of one certain song, Blister in the Sun, which came from their self-titled 1983 debut. But that album is full of good tracks, and we don't believe in one-hit wonders around here. Which is why I'll play you the band's other hit from that album. You are not going to find a better use of xylophone in an 80s song. This is Gone Daddy Gone. As well as alternative rock, one of the other big musical movements of the 1980s was hip-hop. While technically starting in the 70s, it was in the early 80s that the so-called rap music gained its foothold in the cultural landscape, a foothold that turned out to be permanent. Early hip-hop was dominated by groups of dynamic MCs, and in the mid-80s, nobody was as hot as Run DMC. Reverend Run, DMC, and Jam Master Jay, RIP, were one of rap's first mainstream success stories. Sure, all it took was one measly Aerosmith collaboration to get the predominantly Caucasian music charts to take notice, but that is what they did. Within 2 years of Run-DMC's landmark Raising Hell record, acts like LL Cool J, Beastie Boys, Public Enemy and NWA were getting the sort of media attention their direct predecessors could never have hoped to attract. Don't forget, these dudes were style icons to boot. I think the world might still be trying to catch up to their impeccable sneaker tracksuit game circa 1986. That's when they released this song about something near and dear to their hearts.
My appeal, walk through cops and doors and roam all over Coliseum floors. I stepped on stage at Live Aid, all the people gave and the poor got paid. And out of those speakers, I did speak. I wore my sneakers, but I'm not a sneak. My Adidas touched the sand of a foreign land. With Mike in hand, I told to command. My Adidas in the close as can be. We make a mean team, my Adidas and me. We get around together.
I'm not sure how much I could possibly say about Primus. They're one of my all-time favourite bands, and it will forever stick in my craw that they are so readily dismissed as this novelty act. First off, even if they were, there is nothing wrong with that. But that would mean that this here novelty act has been going strong for over 40 years. That is a long time to humour a joke. Maybe the trick is that Primus makes music so unusual, so idiosyncratic, that they've essentially built their own private niche that very few others could ever hope to fill. Frontman Les Claypool is the greatest bass player of all time. That's not up for debate anymore. I am calling it, decision is rendered. And he always had two stone-cold killers backing him up to make a perfect triangle of weird, awesome goodness. Larry Le Lalonde joined in 1989 and has remained the guitarist to this day. Primus are presently up to their fourth full-time drummer, John Hoffman, but him and every single one of the predecessors have been wizards behind the kit. Frankly, you have to be to keep up with this music, because it ain't for the faint of heart. And please, 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 stop saying the Primus sucks. The joke is dead. There is no irony anymore. But we still have Primus. From all the way back in 1995, this is Over the Electric Grapevine.
We'll be right back. friends, vive la France.
Morphine are one of those groups that I think needs a lot more recognition, which is weird because they have an awful lot in common with some of their juggernauts of their day. Start with a moody rock trio with a punk influence. Add in rumours of substance issues and mental health crises, then a singer dies suddenly and tragically. It all sounds a bit familiar, yeah? What I like about Morphine is that they disrupted the classic power trio arrangement by literally amalgamating the bass and the guitar into a single instrument, and they then went and filled the gap with a saxophone. Their setup makes their music drip with atmosphere and low-end gloom, and it makes their name even more apropos. After Mark Sandman's untimely death, after he suffered a heart attack mid-performance, the so-called Git bass rigs were gifted to the band, the President of United States of America, so that the creativity could outlive the creator. Morphine's Cure for Pain from 1993 has earned every ounce of its cult following in the years since, and it is still an incredibly, powerfully sad statement to this day. Now, they technically had two drummers on this record, but since they didn't generally play at the same time, the trio status quo remains intact. This is a lovely little ditty called Thursday.
Then a game of pool. We used to go to a motel across the street. Then the name of the motel was the Wagon Wheel. She said, come on, come on. She said, why don't you come back to my house? She said, my husband's out of town. You know he's gone till the end of the month. Well, I was just so nervous. You know, I couldn't really quite relax. Cause I was never really quite sure when her husband was coming back. One of the neighbors that saw my car. Then they told her, they think they know who you are. Well, her husband, he's a violent man, a very violent and jealous man. Now I have to leave this town, I gotta leave while I still can. Should have kept it every Thursday in the afternoon. For a couple of beers in a game of pool. We should have kept it every Thursday in the afternoon. For a couple of beers in a game of pool. She was pretty good too.
The 90s was weird. That's all I have to say. It was really, really weird. And a lot of really weird music became popular for a minute. Do you remember stuff like Cherry Poppin' Daddies and Squirrel Nut Zippers? But while some of these folks were polishing up their zoot suits, a trio of rough-looking, sharp-dressed Texans were making sure that good old-fashioned rockabilly remained alive and well. The music of Reverend Horton Heat is pure 90s gonzo silliness, and I love it. The group had a modicum of success with their track Psychobilly Freakout, and it sounds precisely as the title might suggest that it does. But the band's entire output through the decade and beyond is stellar. They also put on one hell of a live show, I can attest as much. After early success via Sub Pop Records, Reverend Horton Heat signed a deal in 1994 to co-release their third album, Liquor in the Front, with Interscope. Keep in mind that in 94, Interscope was the home of bands like Helmet, Nine Inch Nails, and indeed, Primus. So a rockabilly trio was an ostensibly strange fit, but Reverend Horton Heat are a strange group of dudes, and their legend just kept growing from there. If you happen to be big into the Tony Hawk games at the turn of the millennium like I was, then this next song should sound awfully familiar. This is I Can't Surf. Muse are one of those bands that I really used to mess with. In the early to mid 2000s, they were one of the most exciting and invigorating rock bands out there. I saw them 6 times in just over a decade. But it's also true they have not done a single thing in well over a decade that made me feel anything, really. I think they might have even recently released a new record, and I've not heard a single thing from it, and I don't mind if that ever changes. But it is true that for a minute there, the hyper-talented trio from Devon, England were the most important band in the world, and I, along with millions of others, were enraptured by them. I really do try to not let nostalgia blind me to my own genuine feelings, so recently I've gone back to listen to some of Muse's earlier work with older, more discerning ears. And truthfully, I reckon a lot of it has held up pretty well, considering that some of this is well over 20 years old now. So for the selection, I'd decide to go all the way back as far as I could. Back to where it all started in 1999, namely the very first track from their very first record. Sunburn was actually the 4th single from this album, Showbiz, which ruins my run of first I was on there, but it's definitely the one that sounds the best to me in 2026. Okay, honesty time. I'd hate for anyone listening right now to think that rock trios and, by extension, the rest of this episode is just going to devolve into nothing but sweaty threesomes of solely white dudes. Honestly, that sounds awful. Because if we're following the timeline now, we are up to the 2000s. And in the 2000s, we had some awesome femme-led three pieces that also added a lot to diversity in lots of other ways. Now, I am personally of the opinion that representation and diversity matters, but even if you aren't, don't worry about any of that. The music I'm about to play for you will speak for itself. So, in order, coming up, we have Yeah Yeah Yeahs with A Date With The Night, Gossip with Don't Make Waves, and Alabama Shakes with Don't Wanna Fight.
what you like, what I like. Why can't we both be right? Attacking, defending, until there's nothing left worth winning. Your pride and my pride. Don't waste my time. And everyone is pleasing, I can't get no relief. Never had no fun, the constant dedication, keeping the water and power on. There ain't no money left, why can't I catch my breath? I'm gonna work myself to death.
I believe that concludes the history portion of the show, so for the next several selections, I want to focus on a few interesting trios that are operating in the present day. If it were up to me, then somebody would be studying the water in Australia, because I'm not sure what else could be causing there to be so much great, strange music coming from our neighbours across the ditch. The trio, known as Glass Beams, arose from the murky depths of the Melbourne Underground during COVID lockdowns and immediately started winning people over with their trippy tunes and fashion sense. Glass Beams create psychedelic instrumentals ideal for soundtracking a visit to a glittery hookah lounge. The band are most easily recognised by the bejeweled doily-like masks they wear on stage. People sure do love their masked weirdo music nowadays, huh? At times, Glass Beams possibly veer close to that much maligned term of so-called world music, but I prefer to think of it as worldly music for people looking for something a little bit outside of the ordinary. And this next track is definitely outside of the ordinary. This is Mahal by Glass Beams.
Thank you.
It is true that heavy metal may have begun in jolly old England in the 60s, but in the 21st century it is a genuinely global phenomenon, having penetrated basically every culture and nation on Earth in one way or another. But even after all that time, Europe has proven itself to be the home of metal's heavier variants, but more so, it has remained a crucible for creativity around the genre's fringes. Many of my favourite acts that push the envelope come from the old country, and I now count Gnome amongst them. Gnome is a stoner metal band from Belgium. Yes, you're right, Gnome is a fantastic name for a stoner metal band, especially a Belgian one, but the name is actually a gateway to the group's whole gimmick. Because you can hardly go about calling yourself Gnome if you're not willing to commit to the pointy hats and the coordinated dances. But most importantly, their music is fun and stupid and wholesome in a way that heavy metal rarely makes work in the modern day. Now this next song was about a man, or more importantly, a god, by the name of John Frum. And if you don't already know about cargo cults, I suggest you do your research because there's some wild stuff from my very own Pacific backyard. Less cults, more Gnome. This is John Frum. Is it weird that I find a lot of classic disco to be so bad as to cause me physical cringe pain, but modern post-disco acolytes like Say She She are right up my alley? I suppose I'm just picky or fickle or whatever. Say She She are an international trio of singers, and they do have a backing band to fill out their funk, soul, disco, new wave sound, but make no mistake, the spotlight is squarely on the three ladies in charge. They're the ones with the quirky, cool vocal harmonies and the burning desire for social justice, specifically women's rights, and that is a pretty awesome combo. Say She She is just one of those groups who can fill a dance floor and have a message. And this next cut is from their most recent album, Cut and Rewind. This is Cut and Rewind. Some might say in this network-connected world of ours that the mystery behind music is dead. But that cannot be entirely true, because the smile happened. When this group was announced to be performing at Glastonbury in 2021, there was confusion, because who on earth were the Smile? The internet loves a rumour mill, but few were expecting a brand new project from Tom York and Johnny Greenwood from Radiohead to fit the bill. The newly christened trio was rounded out by jazz drummer extraordinaire Tom Skinner, and they've gone some ways towards addressing that Radiohead-shaped hole in the modern music landscape. I like to think of the Smile as an alternate evolutionary path that came from a parallel universe. Somewhere in the addition of Skinner and reducing the compositions down to focus tightly around three players, the Smile has revealed a new side to the York-Greenwood creative dynamic that we haven't seen before. The group has even released a trio of good albums from 2022 to 2024, which isn't relevant to the topic, but it is a fun coincidence. It was hard to pick exactly which song from The Smile fit best into this here episode. In the end, I went with the first song of theirs I ever heard on the Glastonbury stream all those years back. From the record, A Light for Attracting Attention, this is Thin Thing. We'll be right back. Criminal of me if I didn't at least mention some of the amazing music trios we have right here in Aotearoa, New Zealand. Little Bushman, Left or Right, and Minwee come immediately to mind as some of my favourite live music acts. But let's talk about The Nudge. The first time I saw The Nudge, they were actually opening for the aforementioned Little Bushman. And as excited I was to see the headliners that night, the main impression I walked away with is that the opening act really earned their paychecks. The trio of Ryan Preble, James Coyle, and Iraya Fakamoe play a mutated form of blues that dips its toes into roots, rock, and monstrous psychedelic jams. Their first album especially, Big Nudge Pie, is one of my favourite Kiwi albums and is well worth some of your time. But I would say the main drawback to being a fan of this group is that they aren't exactly prolific, which does make sense given how in demand the members are for various other projects around the country at all times. Since releasing the debut record in 2011, we've only had one album since, with Dark Arts in 2017. There are rumours of a third presently underway, but I'll believe it when I see it. I'm just kidding around. I'll take quality over quantity any day. From Big Nudge Pie, this is The Nudge with Leaf, but it's spelt with an I, like Erickson. You know, it's actually been quite tricky to get this far into this show without even accidentally talking about supergroups. It makes sense that supergrouping together musicians from disparate bands is a perfect way to construct your formidable trio. The names Emerson, Lake, and Palmer stand amongst the greatest that progressive rock ever had to offer. Individually, their resumes are more than impressive, but together, they were a powerhouse. ELP were prog rock in the year 1970, which just so happens to have been one of its best years. I think a large part of that legacy is that they've succeeded where many of their contemporaries failed, and that they actually knew how to write enjoyable songs sometimes. Yes, it is true that Emerson, Lake, and Palmer absolutely indulged in prog's long-winded, inaccessible tendencies at times, but I would say that they're more responsible for growing an audience for this type of music than basically anyone else. I'll be kind and say that three out of four of their original quadrilogy of records have gone down in history as classics. Not you, Pictures at an Exhibition, you're weird. But it all started back in the year 1970, with the right grouping and the right three guys at the exact right moment created a lucky man. Three lucky men. It's a segue, don't worry about it.
White horses and ladies by the score, all dressed in satin and waiting by the door. Ooh, what a lucky man he was. Ooh, what a lucky man. And feathers, they made up his bed, a gold-covered mattress on which he was led.
Ooh, what a lucky man he was. Blood ran as he cried. No money.
more so than many other genres of music, country can be quite a lonely affair. There are other musicians that are around playing these supporting roles, but the genre has always been dominated by the charismatic troubadour archetype of the solo performer. That's why it's so nice when a few of these ostensibly lone wolves form up together for a group project and have a little fun. The most famous example of this is undoubtedly the Highwaymen, but they were a quartet, so no good to us here. So why not instead look at the fruitful collaboration between Dolly Parton, Linda Ronstadt, and Emmylou Harris that yielded a pair of albums in 1987 and 99. Not all three of them are country artists per se, but they sure sound fantastic together, so who really cares? The trio made their debut with a record titled Trio, and I must say that is very convenient, very easy to remember. The album did great numbers around the world, achieving platinum status at a time when people actually bought albums, if you're old enough to remember that. Trio also earned a Grammy and a Country Music Award, which is both A, very impressive, and B, merely a drop in the bucket of the ladies' individual careers. And for your listening pleasure, this is Parton, Ronstadt, and Harris with Wildflowers.
The hills were alive with wildflowers, and I was as wild, even wilder than they. For at least I could run, they just died in the sun, and I refused to just wither in place. Just a wild mountain rose needing freedoms to grow, so I ran fearing not where I go. When a flower grows wild, it can always survive. Wildflowers don't care where they grow. And the flowers I knew in the fields where I grew were content to be lost in the crowd. They were common and close. I had no room to grow, and I wanted so much to branch out. So I uprooted myself from my home ground and left. Took my dreams and I took to the road. When a flower grows wild, it can always survive. Wildflowers don't care where they grow. I grew up fast and wild, and I never felt right in a garden so different from me. I just never belonged, I just longed to be gone. So the garden one day set me free. I hitched a ride with the wind, and since he was my friend, I just let him decide.
In the year 2009, I worked in a music store, and that gave me the perfect front row seat in which to witness a contender for greatest rock record of the decade arrive in at the absolute 11th hour. It shouldn't come as a surprise that when you take key members from Foo Fighters, Led Zeppelin, and Queens of the Stone Age, you stuff them into a room together, something pretty cool is going to come out the other side. What came out the other side was Them Crooked Vultures, and that is one of those supergroups that is genuinely greater than the sum of its parts. We are all familiar with Dave Grohl's resume, and he's widely established as a workhorse drummer. John Paul Jones was Led Zeppelin's secret weapon and most talented member, don't fight me on this. And then you have Josh Homme in all of his swaggered out glory. It should come as no surprise that the album they put together kicked like a mule. Them Crooked Vultures was a record that made quite an impact at its time, but I felt it was very quickly relegated to history, to the point that many have ended up treating it as a pseudo Queens of the Stone Age record in hindsight. And the pity of it is, the group only has that single album so far. But should the rock gods ever see fit to bless us with a second, we should all consider ourselves very fortunate indeed. But try not to leave it too long, eh boys? 60s rockers are dropping like flies nowadays. This is Gunman.
Finally, you're leading the science. Slash, slash.
I've been pretty good at sticking strictly to trios this whole show, but it's nearly over. If there's one thing I love to do, it's mess with the rules. So I've saved a few selections to the end that are going to stretch what I mean when I say the word trio. It's been a bit of a running joke that every time I take charge of this show, no matter what my chosen topic ends up being, that I can always find a way to shoehorn something in by King Crimson. And today will be no exception. It's always just a matter of figuring out how to justify it. I could, for example, point out that King Crimson did operate as a classic trio when they released one of my favourite of their albums, Red, in 1974, 2 weeks after the band broke up. I want to dig even deeper than that, though, because, you know, of course I am. In the 90s, King Crimson had a very unique band arrangement due to the fact that it had gained new members that decade without getting around to dropping off some of the older ones from the 80s iteration. That meant that between 94 and 97, the band had two guitarists, two bass players, and two drummers, which became known as the double trio era. While they only made a single studio album with this exact arrangement, Thrack, in 96, the legacy of the fabled double trio lives on in proggy infamy. Was it hubris? Was it genius? I don't know if I'm qualified to say, but I like it. This is King Crimson with Sex, Sleep, Eat, Drink, Dream. Well, you know, we are just about done with our odyssey of trios. I would like to thank the big man upstairs, Jumpin' JB, for lending me some of his airwaves. As always, I am grateful for the opportunity to tell my stories and play some tunes for all you lovely folk out there in Radioland. I have, however, saved one final trio to round us off for the show. Not every music trio is going to be made up entirely of musicians, which sounds contrary, but bear with me, I am trying to make a point. The first Gorillaz album from 2001 was built by a specific trio of guys who came into the project from very different backgrounds. Damon Albarn had made his name with Blur, but was looking to stretch his creative legs into something new. Once he had enlisted DJ Dan the Automator for production duties and Tank Girl artist Jamie Hewlett to take charge of visual elements, this cartoon band really started to take shape into what we now know today as Gorillaz. I saw the world premiere of their very first music video on TV, and I assure you, it was completely different from what anyone else was doing at the time. As fate would have it, this specific trio of creators only held together for the group's first album, though. Albarn and Hewlett continued to collaborate as Gorillaz to this day, but the third seat has essentially remained empty since the Automator exited. After trialling Danger Mouse as the guest producer for Demon Days in 05, Albarn has basically taken complete control of the band, both in front of and behind the mic. But that original trio captured some lightning in a bottle, and in doing so, they introduced the world to one of the greatest musical entities of the 21st century, and that is a worthy note to close on. This is 5-4. Thank you once again for having me. I'll see you next time.
My job for me. My job makes no sound. Echo for me. Echo for me underground. Magic on me. Down in bed by city, it made my heart beat no sound, beat no sound, beat no sound.
Free FM podcast was brought to you with support from New Zealand On Air.